the purpose of that community service payment is to directly address the harm that resulted from Mr. Fugelvog's overfishing his IFQ.
Lisa Murkowski's former aide pleads guilty in federal court. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new climate model shows Arctic sea ice could increase for short periods.
Sort of like bumps along the road, right? Like, you know that the overall slope is downward, but you know, you might have to go up some hills to get down the hill.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. First National Bank Alaska. Branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply. Stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Arnie Fugelvog pleaded guilty to federal Lacey Act violations in federal court in Anchorage today as part of a plea deal reached with prosecutors. Fugelvog will be released on his own recognizance, pay no bail. Fugelvog is charged with falsifying fishing records in 2005. At the time, he was a member of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Judge H. Russell Holland presided over the arraignment this morning, asking Fugelvog if he understood all aspects of the proceedings. Fugelvog only answered yes, sir, when Judge Holland questioned him regarding the plea arrangement. The plea agreement involves a 10-month prison sentence plus a fine. If the judge rejects the plea deal, Fugelvog can withdraw his guilty plea. The process would start over, and Fugelvog could then request a jury trial. Lacey Act violations carry a one-year prison sentence and $100,000 fine. Federal prosecutor Andrea Ani Stewart told the court that Fugelvog had cooperated fully throughout the process. Stewart said the government is not seeking Fugelvog's detention at this time and has no objections to allowing him to travel to Canada in the near future. She said if the judge accepts the plea agreement at sentencing in November, the fine will total $150,000.
Defendant Arnie Fugelvog has agreed to pay the fine of $50,000 as well as to make a community service payment of $100,000. The money will be directed to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to be directed for the purpose of enhancing fisheries habitat in the coastal areas of the Gulf of Alaska. And the purpose of that community service payment is to directly address the harm that resulted from Mr. Fugelvog's overfishing his IFQ in that statistical area in that geographical location.
Stewart says Fugelvog no longer owns his individual fishing quota, or IFQ, because he had divested himself of them before the court proceedings got underway. She says NOAA cases of this nature would typically involve some type of sanction or seizure of the IFQ.
When they are dealing with violations, that they often have penalties against an individual's IFQ. If the individual no longer has the IFQ, then there's other remedies that are sought.
Judge Holland then outlined the sentencing guidelines, telling Fugelvog and defendant attorney Jeff Feldman that the court will make its own decision on how the guidelines will be applied. Holland then told Fugelvog that he still had time to walk away from the deal and seek a jury trial. Fugelvog waived that option and entered a guilty plea to charges that he knowingly submitted false records and that the fish he caught at the time were intended to cross state lines. Both Fugelvog and attorney Feldman were tight-lipped as they left the courthouse.
You got anything to say, Arnie, about this deal? Happy with the deal? You want to go through with it? Obviously, you didn't return it. You didn't take it away, so.
I can't make any comments. I'm sorry.
Judge Holland accepted the plea of guilty as charged and has set a sentencing date for November 18th. Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Bob Papp is in Alaska. He toured the North Slope along the with Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, who left yesterday. But the Commandant remained in Barrow, looking into what sort of installation the Coast Guard might put there now that Salazar's Interior Department has awarded the permits for Shell to drill in the Beaufort Sea.
We work together to make sure that safety standards are maintained, that there are sufficient response capabilities up there. And part of that's going to be provided by industry, but part of it has to be provided by the federal government as well. And right now, we've got nothing up there.
The admiral said the Coast Guard will need to have some sort of search and rescue presence on the North Slope, and he needs to be prepared to make recommendations.
I think part of the proposal that I might make is we have a seasonal air station up in the Barrow area, let's say. You'd need a hangar, a place for air crews to be able to sleep and eat, and none of those facilities are there right now.
PAP is being accompanied by Alice Hill, a top aide to Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. Before heading north, both of them made a visit to the 420-foot Coast Guard icebreaker Healy, which was in Kodiak preparing for a research cruise in the Arctic Ocean. The Healy is the nation's only functioning icebreaker. The other two Coast Guard icebreakers, the Polar Star and Polar Sea, are both in dry dock undergoing repairs. Admiral Papp says there is now an outside study that says the nation needs at least 6 icebreakers.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be Coast Guard resources, but I think our country needs more capability up in the Arctic than we have right now. So part of what I'm doing is continuing this process. I'm going to be meeting with Senators Begich and Senator Murkowski along the way. They're both really great supporters of the Coast Guard and the Department of Homeland Security and the activities that we are responsible for up in the Arctic. So it's a continual process to validate what our mission needs, what our requirements are, and then try to work through the administration and the Congress to get the funding for them.
Admiral Papp plans to testify about his findings at a field hearing of the Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Oceans, Atmosphere, Fisheries, and Coast Guard tomorrow at the University of Alaska Anchorage. A new study shows Arctic sea ice may stabilize or even bounce back for brief periods in the coming decades. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
A new high-powered climate model came up with a more nuanced look at Arctic sea ice. Jennifer Kay is a scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research at Boulder, Colorado, and an author of the study. She says the amount of the fluctuations in sea ice extent the model found were surprising.
This study basically suggests that sea ice is very responsive to the short-term fluctuations that exist. You know, if you have three or four cold winters in the Arctic, you're going to get more sea ice. That's just the way that the sea ice will respond.
The model shows sea ice increases that are fairly large. Looking at 10-year time increments during this century, the sea ice increases were as large as the decreases. But Kay says the overall trend is still decreasing. And she says 50 or 60 years out, there's no escaping the loss of sea ice in the summer.
Sort of like bumps along the road, right? Like, you know that the overall slope is downward, but, you know, you might have to go up some hills to get down the hill.
Scientists used to talk about a possible tipping point for Arctic sea ice, but that theory is starting to lose favor. And this study seems to support the idea that there isn't a tipping point. Kay says the potential for a lot of variability in sea ice extent does have policy implications. For example, she says if you're a shipping company, it's important to know what the sea ice is going to do on short-term timescales.
If you're making a long-term business plan, probably a pretty good business plan that you're going to have more navigable Arctic waters in the future. But, you know, over the next 5 years, can you say that this year's conditions are going to look like next year's conditions, which are going to match the conditions in 5 years from now? That's going to be a lot harder thing to do.
The Arctic sea ice hit a record minimum in September 2007. It's extremely low again this year, hitting a new monthly record minimum in July. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking back at the history of the fur seal industry on St. Paul Island.
The fur seal industry was an intricate part of why the state of Alaska was bought, you know.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2011 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Wednesday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The state of Alaska plans to remove an invasive species of sea squirt from Sitka's Whiting Harbor. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game will slip bags over nearly 100 nets that are part of an oyster farm in Whiting Harbor. The nets have been taken over by the invasive tunicate. The bags with the nets inside will be hoisted out of the water and disposed of. Charlie Swanton is with Fish and Game.
We are certainly hoping to have this done within the next 2 to 3 weeks, depending upon availability of those divers. And we're in the process, as of today, to line up those divers.
Swanton says Fish and Game will then look at securing the structures around the harbor and removing them for destruction. Swanton says that won't be cheap.
It is likely just the superstructure alone is probably going to be an exercise that's probably going to cost well over $100,000 when you start thinking of the docks that are in there and all of the other material that is in there. That doesn't say anything for where they're going to be disposed of. And then subsequent to that, what the best mode or method is for removal of that is actually on the rocks and in the substrate in Whiting Harbor.
Swanton says it's his belief that the oyster farm in Whiting Harbor has been put out of business by the invasive tunicate known as D-Vex, the small animal which lives in colonies, coats everything in its path, choking out the ability for plants and mussels to feed or grow. Other areas, including Puget Sound in Washington, have spent thousands attempting to dispose of the small animals. They were first discovered in Sitka's Whiting Harbor last year. Conservation groups filed a petition with the federal government yesterday to protect the Alexander Archipelago wolf under the Endangered Species Act. The groups contend that logging and road building on the Tongass National Forest have put the wolves in jeopardy. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has this report.
The Center for Biological Diversity and Greenpeace filed the 103-page petition with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on Wednesday. Rebecca Noblin is the Alaska director for the Center for Biological Diversity.
The more old-growth forest in the Tongass that we log, the harder it is for deer to get by, which means it's harder for wolves to get by.
Noblin says the roads constructed to support the logging industry are also having a negative effect on wolf populations.
Study after study has shown that the more roads there are, the harder it is for wolves to survive. You have higher rates of hunting and trapping, both legal and illegal. And so we're already seeing unsustainable levels of hunting and trapping on some of the islands in the southeast.
Alaska Forest Association Executive Director Owen Graham says logging has not contributed to a decline in the wolf population.
In the last 50 years, we've logged 4% of the timberlands in southeast Alaska, and yet environmental groups keep attacking our timber supply, is saying we're causing all this harm. Fish populations are much, much higher than they were when we started logging. The deer populations are higher, all the wildlife populations are higher, and yet they don't want to seem to pay any attention to common sense and what's out there. Instead, they refer to these obscure hypotheses that the biologists cook up from time to time.
Graham says an endangered species listing would likely further erode efforts to rebuild the region's shrinking timber industry. Noblin says the conservation groups were unable to provide in their petition specific findings about wolf numbers in Southeast, in large part due to a lack of research on this issue.
There aren't great numbers on wolf populations in the Southeast. We have population numbers from the 90s, but there hasn't been any real effort to get population numbers now. Sort of circumstantial evidence indicates that wolves on Prince of Wales Island have gone down from perhaps around 300 in the 90s to maybe around 150 now. But there hasn't been a real effort to get actual population counts in recent years. So the declines we're seeing tend to be just based on seeing less evidence of wolves where we would expect to see evidence of wolves.
Dave Person is a research biologist with the State Department of Fish and Game. He conducted some of the first successful wolf population research on Prince of Wales Island. He says the wolf population throughout the region is doing quite well, but that's not the case on Prince of Wales.
That population back in the mid-90s when I first started work, or actually early 90s, was very, very healthy and certainly was a relatively high population density compared to the rest of the state. That's not the case now. We don't know what the population level is on the island. We don't have any quantitative numbers that would give us some idea what those population levels are, but we do know that the activity and presence of wolves over there, the amount of activity and the amount of sign, for example, things like feces, scats, and tracks, and is way down.
In 1993, the Biodiversity Legal Foundation and an independent biologist from Haines filed a petition requesting that wolves in Southeast be listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The act is designed to recover a species at risk of extinction. Fish and Wildlife found the listing wasn't warranted at the time, but said it was clear that without significant changes to the Tongass Land Management Plan, the, quote, long-term viability of the Alexander Archipelago wolf is seriously impaired. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
What's a post office mean to a small community? Just ask folks in Point Baker, a Southeast fishing town threatened with the loss of one of its few institutions. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Point Baker's fewer than 30 year-round residents live along a small bay on the remote northwest tip of Southeast's Prince of Wales Island. Others come to visit its few small lodges and bed and breakfasts, or they stop to pick up mail or supplies while trolling or gill netting in nearby waters. That makes its post office an important link to the rest of the world.
It's one of the only real benefits that we receive from the federal government that we can see.
Longtime resident Sam Carlson remembers the days when a freight boat carried staples into Point Baker every few weeks. That's no longer the case.
All of our groceries right now, the way it stands, are mailed out from Ketchikan parcel post, and it's actually almost reasonable, you know, the amount of money you pay. And to lose that, that would mean you'd have to run into town. The closest town's 50 miles away by boat or airplane, and it would create many hardships for just about everybody out here.
Carlson, the town's fire chief, is one of many Alaskans worried that the local post office might close. Point Baker, Douglas, Circle, Kobuk, and Platinum are among three dozen towns on a tentative closure list. Some 3,600 post offices nationwide are threatened under a federal money-saving plan. Carlson says people need to know his town's post office in a multi-purpose building is important.
So it actually contributes a lot to the community, the money that we get for the rent to the federal government, which is a mere pittance. It's only $400 a month or something, helps run the community building, keep it up. And so when other people do come in, they can use the facilities, get off their boats and go check out the library or whatever.
Point Baker is a short boat trip away from Port Protection, a slightly larger Prince of Wales Island fishing town. Its residents also use Point Baker's post office. Beyond that, the nearest towns of any size are Wrangell, Petersburg, and Craig, all are 50 or more miles away by boat or small plane. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, celebrating 7 years of educating Alaskans on clean, local, sustainable, renewable energy. Find out more online at realaska.org. Do you know a nonprofit executive or tribal leader who is at risk for job burnout? Nominate them for a Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical, which provides paid time away for personal renewal and growth. Go to Rasmussen.org for more information, but don't wait. Nominees must complete an application by October 1st. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Last week, the best party in Alaska might have been on an island in the middle of the Bering Sea. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez traveled to St. Paul for the festivities and to find out why they were significant for one rapidly disappearing species.
Three nights straight, the people of St. Paul packed the village's rec hall for a mix of dancing, singing, praying, and feasting. High schoolers vogued to Lady Gaga for a fashion show, and adults placed bids in an auction for vintage luxury goods. They were celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Northern Fur Seal Treaty, which put serious restrictions on the once lucrative practice of hunting fur seals for their pelts. It might seem a little weird that a piece of arcane environmental law was a cause for such a blowout, But on top of being the first international wildlife conservation agreement in history, that document also saved the seals from extinction while guaranteeing the native people of the Pribilof Islands the right to a subsistence harvest. The centennial gave the Aleuts who live in St. Paul a chance to remember a major part of Alaska's history that's often overlooked.
The fur seal industry was an intricate part of why the state of Alaska was bought, you know. It wasn't for oil or for timber or even for fishing, you know. That all came later.
The history he describes is a difficult one. The people of the Pribilofs were originally from the Aleutian Islands, and they were forcibly displaced by the Russians and made to hunt seals. Then they worked the commercial seal harvest as wards of the U.S. government for low wages during much of the 20th century.
Sometimes they worked 10 hours, 8 hours a day. And I got happy when I got to step two when I was getting $34 a month, you know, and that was big wages, you know. And that wasn't in 1800 either, that was in 1950-something, you know.
In the 1980s, the government pulled out of St. Paul, and the commercial industry for fur seal pelts disappeared. St. Paul residents continued their small subsistence harvest of the young male seals, using that meat through the winter months. Now the people of St. Paul face another challenge. The fur seal population is shrinking at a rate of about 6% a year. Ryan Berner is a wildlife technician working in St. Paul.
The populations now, based on bull counts and also counts of pup production, are less than one-fifth of what they were in their most recent peak, which was 1950. And so we're still seeing a pretty solid decline every year.
Berner spends his days walking along St. Paul's rocky cliffs, looking for tag seals in the rookeries and haulouts. That type of data will be used to help determine this year's population count. Right now, it's not really clear what's causing the seals to disappear. There's a whole mess of factors that could be putting stress on the seals, from climate change to competition from fisheries to pollution to whale predation. What is clear is that their continued decline will have consequences for the ecosystem, and that it will also have an effect on the culture and diet of St. Paul's residents. During the centennial celebration, the drop in population numbers wasn't overlooked. At the groundbreaking of a new monument to honor the sealers of St. Paul, the director of the National Marine Mammal Laboratory, John Bankson, spoke of the importance of protecting the seals.
The need for responsible stewardship of fur seals and their environment is as great today as it has ever been.
Aqualina Lestinkoff, director of the tribal government of St. Paul, also addressed the population drop and spoke of a need to conserve a species and a culture. She says that while the situation is worrisome, she believes that the fur seals may be able to bounce back once again, just like they did a century ago.
I hope that we have another 100 years in front of us. I hope there are people here eating seal a few hundred years from now.
It's going to take a lot of work for that to happen, but St. Paul's residents aren't strangers to that. During the centennial, local rock group The DL Band played a song called Slaves of the Harvest. It was written in 1978, and it's about the role the seals played in shaping the community. For a song that focuses on all of the hardships that the sealers faced, it's a pretty catchy tune, and even upbeat at points. In one of the final verses, the guitarist sings about change and hope for self-determination. And the centennial was just as much about that as it was the fur seals. Because here, the lives of the people and the seals are linked. And the dream is that things will stay that way, indefinitely. Reporting from St. Paul, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
An Inupiaq filmmaker is finding it hard to get his film shown to audiences, even though On the Ice has been shown and won awards in venues such as the Sundance Film Festival and Berlin International Film Festival. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Inupiaq Andrew McLean is originally from Barrow and filmed his first feature film there last year. Reviewers use words like masterful, confident, and compelling to describe the film, which is entitled On the Ice. McLean says On the Ice is a drama that shows the spectacular beauty and unique character of life in a small Arctic community.
The story is about
two young men who've grown up together as best friends, a tragic killing that happens, and then a cover-up of that killing.
At Sundance, On the Ice was one of 16 films selected for viewing from more than 1,000 entries in its category. It won Best First Feature at the Berlin International Film Festival and Best New American Film at the Seattle Film Festival. It's been shown at festivals in places such as Singapore, Sydney, Australia, and St. Petersburg, Russia. Yet McLean says he's trying to raise enough money to get it shown in 10 theaters in Alaska and the lower 48.
We want to be able to release it in Alaska, you know, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Nome, Juneau, as many places in Alaska as we can, as well as take it to communities around the lower 48 that we think there's a real audiences, you know, people who are Native American or interested in films about Native Americans.
McLean says traditional distributors are leery of small independent films with no big-name stars to help with sales. To distribute the film, McLean says the Sundance Institute is helping with marketing and fundraising, and the producers are soliciting donations through the internet funding platform at Kickstarter.com.
On Kickstarter, we're asking... we're trying to raise $80,000, and we have until September 8th to do that. If we don't raise the $80,000 by then we get nothing.
McLean says the Kickstarter fundraiser started a few weeks ago and is getting off to a slow start.
I think we're around 12,000 right now, so we've got a long ways to go. We've been making steady progress every day, but we've definitely got a long ways to go to hit the 80,000.
The plot for On the Ice is based on McLean's earlier film, Sukumi, an Inupiaq language film that Filmmaker magazine listed as one of the 10 best unseen films of 2008. McLean's other films include Seal Hunting with Dad and The Snaring Madman. In Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alexandra Gutierrez on St. Paul Island, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at NMSUSA.com. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.